and this is William Del Pilar, the conservative Latino with
Big John to somebody who likes to eat.
I don't know if John likes to eat, but he did take me to a great sandwich. I don't know if it was deli or natural fast food franchise. What was it, Big John?
That was, if I'm recalling, it's the last time you came to New York. We went to Junior's famous cheesecake in Times Square, which
it was huge.
It was huge and well known, obviously, for their cheesecakes, but their sandwiches and their burgers are quite delicious. So yeah, I think that's where we went. Shout out to Juniors of Brooklyn.
And this is why John and I don't know if this is why we get along, but John and I became friends. And ironically, John wasn't part of the clique. I was part of the clique, but not part of the clique, meaning I kept my distance because I was there for business. But right. People don't understand. I don't gravitate to people because of their positions in life and what I can get from them. I gravitate to people who I get along with, even if we argue like cats and dogs, because there's a certain karmic energy that right. aligns us, you know. I think back in the day, John, that's why they had revolutions every 50 years, all that karmic energy, hating the elite.
Well, not only that, but they probably knew they were going to die soon, so they figured, we might as well shake things up.
Well, hell, when your lifespan was 35, you know, I can see that. Yeah. But, John, we've got a great show tonight.
Do we?
Yes, sir. We got a couple of NFL takes. Okay. There have been a couple of key signings. I don't view one of them as a key signing as much as the situation makes it a key signing, because I view it as, what's the big deal?
Right.
And the other one is a key signing because it's a team-friendly contract. It's a Tom Brady-esque contract.
Okay.
And it could potentially create better things for this team. And we'll get to both of those. And the USFL is back. Were you aware they were back, John?
Barely. Barely.
Were you aware President Trump was a former owner of the USFL?
Sure. The Jersey Generals.
That's right. So we're going to talk about the USFL. I kind of disagree with what I see out there in regards to some of the positives. I don't see any positives. But that said, as a working class guy, as a 5'7" Latino who was never able to play football, as somebody who has always overachieved when I have created success for myself, I love the fact that some of these players and coaches are going to be able to be seen. It's kind of like a sizzle wheel they're creating. It always happens. Some of these guys will make the leap back into the NFL. Sure. And there's some big name players. Let me take that back. They're not big name players, but players that have played in the NFL, both on the coaching level, some big name coaches now, right. and some players, including a first round draft pick. And from there, we are going to talk once again about Gilbert Gottfried. And Jackie, this is for you, because the message you sent me aggravated me a little bit, not in a bad way. I get along with her and I love her to death, but people seem to misconstrue Gilbert Gottfried, and she said, well, he supports pedophilia. And my first take was, no, he doesn't. Do you not know what the aristocrats? And I said it that way, and I was thinking it that way, but the reality is I had not learned about it until the week prior.
And
I read up on him. So Big John is going to explain to us a little bit about Gilbert Gottfried, the aristocrats, and it's I don't know about history, but how it fits in that world and what it is.
Sure.
And is there still room for it in today's cancel culture? So any words, John, before we get going here?
Just let's go. Let's do it. I'm ready
All
to
right.
go, baby.
Let me grab my notes, people, and we will get to it. Okay. First topic at hand is Sammy Watkins.
And Sammy. The fact
That's right, Sammy. John, what can you tell us about Sammy? How did he get a start, and what's become of him?
Well, Sammy Watkins, coming out of college, was drafted by the Bills. He was a speedster. He was what you would think when he came out. People viewed him as like a Justin Jefferson type is today, like somebody who came out. He was heralded. I'm not going to say he's had a horrible career, but he's certainly been a bust. For where he was drafted and the expectations around him.
Where was he drafted?
He was drafted by Buffalo. Where was he? He was in the first round. I don't remember exactly what slot right now.
Number 4 overall.
Number four overall. And if I'm not mistaken, they may have traded up to get him too. So there was a lot of expectations around him. Now, in some cases, he didn't always play with the best quarterbacks, but still underperformed. Only 348 catches for his career, just 34 touchdowns. But he's still relatively young. He'll turn 29 just before the start of this NFL season.
Did much of his production come early in the career?
I think a lot of it did come earlier. He's been on some decent teams, like most recently with the Chiefs and with the Ravens last year. Here's the thing. Part of it is that he's very injury prone. The other thing is that I think he just hasn't lived up. I don't know what reason. I don't know if it's mental or physical, but the injuries have played a part. I view him as a speedster, but I view him that in the right circumstance, he can be a very productive player within the system, certainly as a complementary receiver. So when you have a Tyreek Hill, Sammy Watkins becomes a very good wide receiver too for you if you're on Kansas City. If you've got a Hollywood Brown in Baltimore last year, you should have had a good year out of Watkins at number two, but again, he only caught 27 for almost 400 yards.
Right.
Just one touchdown. So he's been one of these underperformers. That's how I would describe his career. Underperforming. Underwhelming.
Right. I think you could look at him as the Tony Mandarich of wide receivers. Tony Mandarich was Tony Mandarich was the number one overall pick for the Green Bay Packers, a bust, steroid guy. However,
the incredible ball.
People forget he actually went on to have what you would call a very serviceable career
with the Colts.
After the hoopla died and all that, he had some good years with the Colts, and that's what Sammy Watkins at number four expected to make an impact. Injuries have taken his toll. His past three seasons, he's averaged what, 12 games? His career, 14 games, and I'm being generous.
Yeah.
And he's been paid, so maybe that took a little bit of his desire for that self-continual improvement. I mean, in March of 2018, he signed a 3-year, $48 million contract with the Chiefs. Here's his numbers.
Crazy.
40 receptions, 2019. 52 receptions, 673 yards, 3 touchdowns. 2020, 37 receptions for 421 receiving yards and 2 touchdowns. Now, he came clutch in the playoffs and helped them win a Super Bowl. But how he got that contract is beyond me. Maybe that affected his play. I don't know. But the point is he is still young enough to be serviceable, because right now, he's not even Tony Mandarich. Mandarich came back to become serviceable. We've got to see if he can become serviceable. But the reason we're talking about him is because of all the soap opera that's been surrounding the Green Bay Packers over the past year, and they had no receiver. Even that guy, who's that guy, Marquez something, that they thought could
Marquez
come up.
Marquez Valdez-Scanlon, he ended up going to Chicago.
He even left town. So not only
By the way, if you remember, I predicted early on, I said, people are assuming he's going back to Green Bay. He's not.
That's right.
I told
That's
everyone,
right.
I said, he's not going to stay there without Davante Adams. He's not a number one. He's
That's
going somewhere
right.
else.
So in essence, all they did to me was get depth here. And the reason we're talking about Sammy is because there's a void at wide receiver, and Sammy was an overall number four pick. Now, as I've gotten older, I tend to be optimistic and look at the best in players, especially when they don't make waves and are not bad guys. I hope he can turn it around. But after 8 seasons, I think he is what he is. He got a 1-year prove-it deal. And what was it? $4 million. Last year, I think it was $8 million. So it keeps going down after that $48 million. But, John, I'd love to be a pauper only getting $4 million for this year, wouldn't you?
Yeah, I know what you're saying. But here's what's interesting to me. I don't think he's going to be successful in Green Bay, even with Aaron Rodgers. Because unless Green Bay either swings a deal and gets someone like a DK Metcalf closer to the draft, I don't see him carrying the number one receiver position.
No. I don't think he was brought in to be number one. I think he was brought in that they need somebody, they need a veteran on the field. I mean, Randall Cobb, I think he was cut, but has he come back? I'm not sure.
Even if he hasn't, he should be. He's done.
Yeah, but my point is they're probably looking at him in that type of veteran role, maybe a little bit of leadership, help whoever they bring in. He has a ring, former number one pick, and talk about it.
But that's what I said, right? Unless they bring in a true number one, because even if they end up drafting a receiver at the bottom of the first, or if they package their two picks to move up to get to draft a receiver, that situation is a mess. It's toxic. It's rare that a rookie receiver comes in as a wide receiver one and leads the team. You know, it's a rare – I wouldn't count on it if I were a Packers fan.
I'd
say one thing, William. One thing that shocked me this offseason, talk about two number one picks that have had different career trajectories. Compare Sammy Watkins to someone like Brandon Cooks. Brandon Cooks, we all know, seems to get traded every other year. Right?
Yeah, he's productive.
But every other year he gets traded for a first-round pick, right?
He must be. You know, I wonder that, too. And I've got a lot of contacts from back in my previous life. And that's one of the questions I do want to reach out and find out. What's the story? I don't know. Is it his attitude? He doesn't get along with people?
But that's the thing. I've heard is that he's a great teammate. He's productive. But you know what it is? It's
maybe he's not clutch. I mean, let's be honest. There's people who can, like Derek LaVille. Remember Derek LaVille after he replaced the guy who went to Philadelphia, Ricky Waters. Yeah. Derek LaVille replaced Ricky Waters in San Francisco. Derek LaVille, you looked at his numbers. He was extremely productive. But I always remember talking to the beat reporters, whether it was a team playing him, playing against him, or even the 49er beat reporters. They said Derek LaVille is not the player opposing defenses prep for, so they don't care. His numbers may look nice, but he's not a threat on the field. But Brandon Cooks was a deep threat, wasn't he?
Yeah, he's always a deep threat. He still has that speed. And here's the thing. It's not like he's getting cut and resigning the way Watkins is.
Yeah.
Cooks is getting traded up until now, and he gets traded for first-round picks.
Well, he did get resigned by the Texans.
Yes, right. So here's my point. If I was either the Packers or somebody like the Bears, even necessarily someone who thinks they're making a move with a young quarterback or a veteran quarterback, I would have explored trading for Cooks rather than signing a Watkins. You know what I mean?
No, I agree. I agree.
Because I don't think it would have taken a first to get Cooks off of Houston because they're in rebuild mode. So you throw them a second or a third. I'm sure they would have taken that for Cooks. Probably. But I would have explored a trade for Cooks. Maybe they did, and it just didn't happen. But to me, I'd much rather have a Brandon Cooks. And again, people love him. He's very productive. Even last year with the Texans, he was super productive last year with a carousel of like scrub quarterbacks. You
actually,
know,
so, I don't think it wasn't a carousel. It was David Mills, and
He also had Tyrod Taylor for
a couple
that of
games, was injury that took him out, and then he didn't play. I think. Okay, so. 3 points before we move on. This will be – Sammy was drafted by Buffalo, went to the Rams in 2017, had a good season there, then went to Kansas City, then went to Baltimore. So this will be his 15th in 8 years. Now, the reason I bring that up is because the positives now. The Packers head coach, Matt LaFleur, was Rams offensive coordinator during the 2017 season, and Jason Ravel, he's now the Packers receivers coach, passing game coordinator, and he was on the Bills staff when Watkins was there, and he was in various roles. So he's got a couple of tie-ins that understand his strengths, his weaknesses, so he'll go in there, and the team will have an understanding of what they're getting, and my point is hopefully a foundation they can build on. You know, so let's hope for the best. I always like to see players do well, only because 15 years ago I wrote an article how 50% of these guys lose their money afterwards.
Right.
Okay, here's some big news. It's not big news anymore. It was never big news. It was just part of the news. But it's big news after we're done talking about it. Derek Carr signs his extension with the Raiders.
Yeah.
3-year extension worth $121.5 million. $40.5 million average yearly salary. Makes him the fifth highest paid NFL quarterback on an annual basis. What are your thoughts about that signing, Big John?
So I have mixed feelings about it. So first of all, I'll say this. I'm a Derek Carr fan. I think Derek Carr is a good NFL quarterback. I don't think he's a great NFL quarterback.
Okay. Just to validate what you're saying,
yeah.
As you know me, I'm a research hound.
Yep.
Most articles, most people that came across saying he's not a top five quarterback. No. They could see that. But they did say he's a top 10 quarterback. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, that's my feeling, right? Like, I think he's the type of quarterback that could take you to a Super Bowl on a strong team. I don't think he's someone who can put the team on his back. Now, I also say that because I think he's been unfairly crapped upon the last couple of years. I think people judge him way too harshly, and mainly because he's in the division with Patrick Mahomes, right, or with Justin Herbert. So I think, you know, I think he's a very good quarterback. I think he's a very solid quarterback. I think he can win. I think the Raiders can win with him. Now that they gave him Davante Adams, he has Darren Waller at tight end. He has Edwards as another wide receiver. He's got Renfro in the slot. He's got Josh Jacobs in the backfield. I'm telling you, if that offensive line is just average, I'm not even talking good, just average, there's no excuse for him to fail this season. And I'm not even saying that he failed before, but he should be pretty good this season. Now, is he worth $40 million? Is he worth being the fifth highest paid NFL quarterback? No. Is he just lucky? I think he's just in the right place at the right time. And you know me, William, there's no such thing as the wrong price. The price is what your value demands in the market.
Supply and demand.
It's supply and demand. And right now, he said, this is what I want, and someone paid it. So guess what? That's what he's worth. He's worth $40.5 million a year.
Whoa. He's valued at $40.5 million, but he may or may not be worth it.
Well, right. I think you meant it's his worth, it's his value because that's what he got paid.
Yeah.
Are they going to get that much return out of it? That's a different story. I don't think they will. Because they're tying up so much money between him and Adams, and probably Waller too.
Okay, hold on. So that's where I want to disagree with you, but I'm not sure if I'm 100% correct because I'm not a capologist. But again, I'm a book smart fool to be a dumb little Latino. According to what I discovered is that he's got a very flexible and team friendly Tom Brady-esque type contract.
Right.
So the salary cap won't be as affected as, say, Aaron Rodgers is going to destroy the Packers, or Patrick Mahomes is already dismantling the Chiefs.
Right.
And it has nothing to do with dislike or like of those players. It's the reality of those contracts.
It's just
and
numbers.
Egos. We all have egos.
Yep.
Sometimes my ego's so big I can't fit through the door. My head's so big. But that said, I also don't know if I agree with you in terms of his work. I don't disagree, but I don't agree. And here's why. He was selected in the second round of the 2014 NFL draft. Who were his first two head coaches?
Jack Del Rio and Dennis Allen.
And what are they, John?
Oh, they were defensive coaches.
That's right. So when John Gruden and people, I cannot wait for that court case to come out where John Gruden got fired, because what he said was, I don't want to say disgusting or revolting, but was wrong, you know? But I wonder what those other thousands of emails, I want to know what Maurice Carr, what he said, because his lips have gotten him in trouble. Ooh, I shouldn't have said it that way. My apologies. His mouth has gotten him in trouble with how he speaks too. But anyway, I'm digressing. I just think it's going to be a battle royale when the facts and those emails start becoming public through court documents. Okay, so when John Gruden came into play and became the coach, he completed nearly 69% of his passes, and then he clips 4,000 yards for the first time in 2018. In 2019, a 70% completion rate, 21 touchdowns, 8 interceptions.
Right.
2020, over 4,000 yards, 27 TDs, only 9 interceptions. Gruden gets unceremoniously canned, drops down to 68% completion rate, which isn't bad, but only 23 touchdowns and 14 interceptions. So the impact an offensive-minded head coach had with him was, I don't want to say night and day, but maybe 12 hours difference night and day. Well, that is
also the stability. I mean, in essence, even last season, even though Gruden got fired, it was still Gruden's essential scheme for three seasons.
It doesn't matter though, John. That's the difference between Clinton and Gore. Clinton got elected and actually was able to work at Congress. Gore couldn't even get elected. And my point being is, you can have two similar men, but one can succeed where the other.
I understand that. I was trying to say that in support, meaning that when Carr got an offensive-minded coach and he got some stability in his coaching staff, he performed. He did well. He's getting Josh McDaniels now, who has worked with other quarterbacks, notably all the New England quarterbacks.
And who are they, John? Because this is important for the public to understand why I'm going down this road.
There's obviously Brady. Tom Brady. Tom Brady.
I'm kidding.
I know you are. Matt Castle,
what's important about Matt Castle?
He left and went to the Chiefs.
But his play regressed after he left Josh McDaniels.
Exactly. He went to the Chiefs for one season.
He was there for two or three seasons.
No, but I'm saying he basically left after one good season when he backed up the year Brady got hurt.
Torn ACL, I think that was.
Right. Then you had Garoppolo, obviously, who was the backup to Brady that always looked good for the one time he got into a game. Brissett is another one.
Brissett was actually, remember how good he looked? He came in. He was the third quarterback.
Yeah.
I can't remember if it was Garoppolo or Hoyer, whoever. Somebody got backup got hurt, and he came in and looked good. And then I always thought he had talent, but he was an immense flop. He was like not cold. But the point is, under Josh McDaniels,
obviously Mac Jones as a rookie last season.
So a lot of these quarterbacks went on to start somewhere else.
Yeah, and let's face it, Tebow made the playoffs with McDaniels.
No, I looked that up, brother. I thought the same thing. I looked that up. It was the following year, I think. Yeah.
Oh.
Because I was like, why aren't they talking about Tebow? I mean, if anything, that was that. You know?
Because I know McDaniels.
Tebow.
McDaniels drafted him, right. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah,
but regardless, he has sort of a reputation as being a quarterback whisperer, someone who seems to get the most out of his quarterbacks, and he's certainly considered a very innovative offensive mind, I think, in most circles. So
now, who do we have on the field today, then?
So, I'm sorry.
Daniel's calling the plays.
Yeah.
And he's got all those players around him. Davante Adams. Darren Waller, like you said, Brandon Jacobs. I think the line has to be better than average.
Not Brandon Jacobs, Josh Jacobs.
Josh Jacobs.
Yeah.
Josh Jacobs. Because I don't think Josh Jacobs is the type of back. I think he needs a strong line. People don't realize one reason Emmitt Smith is synonymous with success and seems one of the greatest running backs. I don't think he was. I think you put him in Chicago's line of the 70s where Walter Payton was still Walter Payton or in Buffalo where the juice was the juice. Those were behind horrible lines. Emmitt has some of the greatest lines. I think Jacobs needs a strong line to take it to the next level. So if they get that strong line with all these other pieces, some people believe he may have a career year. Now, you said you didn't view him as a top 10, as a top 5 quarterback, but with McDaniels calling, and I'm not talking wins or losses. I'm talking stats here, data, with McDaniels calling the plays, with Jacobs, with Davante Adams, with Waller, do you think he could make the leap to become a top 5 quarterback?
No, because it's a numbers game, right? So, let's see if we can name 5 quarterbacks we think will be above him, right? Mahomes, Herbert,
Brady, the Rams guy.
What was that? Oh, Matt Stafford. You can have Lamar Jackson in there, right?
I don't view any of those guys.
Russell Wilson, right? Like you can have guys that you can name that are. You can name 5 guys above him, but my point being, going into the season, does he have the possibility? Of course, anyone does. You know. But I think that he should have a very solid season. Okay, let's split the difference. He's a top 7 quarterback probably.
Hold on. One more caveat to throw at you to try to convince you.
Okay.
He's playing in the AFC West. Russell Wilson. Patrick Mahomes.
Justin Herbert.
Justin Herbert. I mean, those are going to be shootouts. And my point being is, so for 8 games, he will be airing it out. So I'm not saying he will, but I am saying the sky's the limit for him to have a career year. Can he pull it off? I don't know, because for some reason there is a stigma on the Raiders. And it is not just win, baby. It's just find a way to choke, baby. That's been their stigma the last 20 years.
Yeah, you know? I am optimistic about Carr's improvement, chances to improve this year. And yeah, I don't think it's a crazy statement to say he'll have a career year. I don't dismiss it out of hand. Will he end up being a top 5 quarterback? Probably not.
Okay, so let's get your final prediction. Do you think with this team that the Raiders can compete for the AFC West? And out of the top 10, where do you see them? Closer to 5 or closer to 10? And
then the we'll Raiders, move on. The Raiders or Carr?
Do you think the Raiders can compete to capture the AFC West? And part 2 of the question, where do you see Carr? Closer to the top 5 this year or more on the back end of the top 10?
Okay, if I had to pick a ranking, I'll answer the second part. I think Carr will end up somewhere around 7.
God, what about political answer? Did you run for office, brother?
I should have. So he'll be somewhere around 7. I don't think he'll be in the top 5. Can the Raiders compete? They'll compete. That West is so tough, though. I don't see them coming out of the West.
Well, you know what?
They might get a wild card.
Yeah. I live in San – well, they got it last year. I live in San Diego. And outside of the Bobby Ross 2 or 3 great magical season, they just – it's like in their DNA. Let me give this game away in the last couple of minutes. They can overcome the Chargers.
The thing that's difficult is they still have to contend with the Chiefs. And a lot of this, I think, is also going to be predicated on the draft too, right? The Raiders are essentially set. Unless they trade assets to get capital, they're set, right? Their first pick doesn't come till round 3 or 4, right? So I think they're pretty much set. What you see is what you're going to get. Look, the Chiefs have 2 first-round picks. Let's see what they do with those. Like, they can restock their defense fairly easily, right?
Maybe, but they need a receiver. So the odds of them going receiver is key. And what you just said plays a very important part in terms of the Packers and Watkins. You're not going to get a rookie receiver. Or the odds, because you can. There have been first-year receivers that have come and performed. But the odds are stacked against the Chiefs and the Packers being able to do that. And let me remind America.
They're at the bottom of the first round. They're both at the bottom of the first round. That's the problem.
But let me remind the world here. The Chiefs, you know, they skyrocketed up. Super Bowl win following year. Super Bowl loss following year. They didn't even make it to the Super Bowl.
Right.
You know, so as Marcellus Wiley, who I really love, I mean, the guy just calls it like it is. They're trending down. So don't assume the Chiefs are the hit team they are, because the Chargers, as much as I just bagged on them, are trending up. They still have the core there. The Raiders are trending up. The Chiefs, they're trending down. I mean, they lost Tyreek Hill. That doesn't mean they're not going to compete. And I'm just saying it's not a given. Oh, my God, why am I drawing a blank here? Who's the fourth team?
The Broncos.
That's the Broncos. I don't know where the Broncos are right now in terms of compared to the other teams.
I think they look strong because out of the 4 teams, they have the best defense right now.
Yeah, I was about to say defensively. But that's going to be an
not that they've got Wilson, that receiving core looks pretty good. Right? Because they had the 3 good receivers. They had Patrick, Jerry Jeudy, and Courtland Sutton, right? They had Sutton, Jeudy, and Patrick. Losing Fant hurts a little bit, but they can replace him.
And there's no offense at tight end.
The tight end, they can replace him. And they still have the running back, Williams, right? So their offense is still pretty good. They have a nice offensive line, and they have the best defense. So between all that, I think they're in – so that AFC West is loaded, man. the worst team is still a very good team. Whoever ends up being the worst team there.
The worst team can compete for a playoff spot going into the final couple of weeks.
And the worst team in that division would be battling for a top spot in every other division.
Right, right. It's one of those things where the wild card team could be an 11-5 team or 12-4 team.
You're right. Yeah.
All right, people, let's move on. And let's move on to John's favorite president and his former league and team. The USFL. First of all, the hat tip to CBS Sports. They had it's not a long article, but they have a great article on the USFL 2022, the schedule players. In fact, if you go to their website, it's called USFL 2022: schedule players, coaches, everything to know about the new football league. And a hat tip to Athlon Sports, who I actually go way back with Athlon Sports. I had a great relationship with them. However, they were some greedy-ass people over there. They would talk a great game, and we could never pull the trigger on the actual deal because they were just bad business people,
Oh, my goodness. All the dirt is coming out now.
Yeah. But they had good people over there. It was just the management I never met. It's kind of like, well, management says this. I'm like, I don't care. We're not doing that. But anyway, hats tip to Athlon Sports. They had a great article there. USFL, what you need to know about the new professional football league. John, tell us a little bit about their history, if you can.
So, sure. The USFL's originated as a spring summer league, and it was supposed to compete with the NFL. And it's really funny. One of the owners, obviously, famously, was Donald Trump. And
the greatest president in the United States, according to John.
According to most people. But anyway, so Trump was an owner. And people forget, the USFL kind of started its life being the equivalent of the old AFL when it challenged the NFL in 1960, right? Because they were raiding talent in each draft, right? It was back to those draft wars.
I mean, think about it. Steve Young,
Jim Kelly, Herschel Walker, Reggie White. People forget about Reggie White. Mike Rozier. There were a lot of guys that would have went in the first round. The reason Irving Fryer went so high that year, I think he went number one overall, was because everyone who would have been the number one pick got poached by the USFL, right? The USFL also famously took underclassmen when the NFL did not. So Marcus Dupree, who was a 19-year-old sophomore, got drafted and it destroyed his career because he was way too young for professional football. But anyway, so the USFL started as a rebel league. It started with the promise of we're going to take on the NFL, we're going to do what the AFL did. Right. There's a lot of, I don't know, was their whole plan to be just rebellious enough to be absorbed by the NFL so the eight teams could be absorbed into it? Maybe. I don't know. But I'll never forget this. I was actually at a Mets game. I think it was in 86. Yeah, in 86 when the news of the trial broke. Because they had sued the NFL on the basis of antitrust, because they thought the NFL monopolized the TV contracts. So I was in the old Shea Stadium, and the scoreboard flashed the news. The verdict in the USFL-NFL case has been handed down. The USFL wins on all counts, and you could hear the crowd go, yeah! Like, people seemed happy. And then thing says, damages are $1.
Yeah.
And then, of course, trebled.
The damages, it was what, about $4, $3?
It was like $3 and change. People think I'm misstating. No, that's not like $3 million or $3 billion. It was $3.76. And I think as a joke, I was watching an old NFL film saying, somebody in the NFL, maybe Roselle, had the check, a copy of the check they sent, which was $3.76. Obviously, after that, the league folded. The USFL folded. They were counting on that lawsuit to win the lawsuit and get punitive damages, like pay us for pain and suffering. They didn't get – so they won on principle and they lost in practice.
Right. And that's how life works sometimes, I thought they got a little bit of a raw deal, but, because let's be honest, these leagues are monopolies in a way.
Not in a way. They are monopolies.
NFL, so to see – David versus Goliath, and David wins but still goes home the loser. It's kind of sad to see for the little guys.
It is to some extent. And listen, historically, rival leagues, the only one that had any traction was the AFL.
But why is that? They were on the verge of collapse except for what moment in
Well, there were time. Two things in the AFL that was huge for them. One is, from the get-go, they played a different type of football for back then. I'm talking for the 60s, right? So the AFL was like more the run and shoot. It was throwing the ball around.
More up-tempo. More modern.
It was up-tempo. It was more fun. You had trick plays like triple flea flickers, like which in the NFL – in 1960, you never saw that. What you saw, like wishbone offenses in the NFL.
Oh yeah, the option was popular into the early 60s.
Yeah, they ran. You know, crazy.
They threw boring. When they had to.
Yeah, they only threw when they had to. Exactly. Whereas the AFL was, we're throwing bombs. And if you think of the Mad Bomber, Daryl LaMonica, if you think of Bambi, that was his nickname. I can't remember.
Or the great one, Willie
Jeff. The one for the Chargers. His nickname was Bambi.
Jack Kemp.
Jeff Kemp was the quarterback for the Bills.
Okay.
The Jets stealing Joe Namath, who was the top quarterback prospect. That was huge, you know, when they poached him away from the NFL. And if you watch some of these documentaries, it was like CIA-level nonsense going on. Like, one league would hide a college kid, literally take him to a hotel, lock him in, and say, you can't talk to the other league's agents, and we'll pay you this much to shut up and stay in the hotel room. We'll feed you. We'll pay you.
Kind of sounds like the government and the homeless are the illegals now, huh?
Right. also, the AFL had their secret weapon. See, a lot of people credit Lamar Hunt, but the real secret weapon for the AFL was Al Davis.
Because
Al Davis wanted to go to war with the NFL. And when the NFL finally agreed to merge with the AFL, Al Davis was the one owner in the AFL who said, why are we merging with them? They should be merging with us. Better yet, why don't we just keep attacking till we destroy them? Because he hated the NFL. He was like, why don't we destroy the NFL? Why are we merging with them? But the other owners felt, okay, let's merge. There's more money with the NFL. And then, of course.
Big John, it wasn't just that. You know, Al Davis, love him or hate him, he did live the big lie to an extent. He was a general managing partner. Everyone assumed he was a full owner of that team, but there were other partners there. And the truth of the matter is the AFL was struggling. The only reason they actually started those talks was because the AFL got their asses kicked year one, year two in the Super Bowl. And it was Broadway Joe, the first time ever in the history of American sports. I guarantee the win.
And
they were heavy underdogs against, technically I want to say Johnny Unitas' Colts, but I think it was Earl Morrell.
It was Earl Morrell's Colts. By that point, Johnny U had become a backup, but he came in when Morrell got when Morrell was
I
having
can't remember an injury or something, wasn't it, or something like that?
Well, no, Earl Morrell just was ineffective during the Super Bowl, so they brought in Johnny Unitas.
But they were the heavy favorites.
Well, the Jets were 16-point underdogs to the Colts.
Oh, what city? What city were the Colts in at the time?
Baltimore.
That's right, baby. The bombs are more cold.
Anyway, so you're right. That was a big moment for the AFL and brought parity.
You say parity, and I agree that's the right word. But in today's politically correct world, it brought equality.
I'll skip that. It brought parity. But the thing
let's get back to the USFL, though.
Yeah, so the USFL, my point was that the AFL was the last successful competitor to the NFL. People forget the WFL. Formed in the mid-70s.
Oh, my God, with Larry Zonka.
Larry Zonka, Jim Kick, Paul Warfield all left the world champion Dolphins to go to the World Football League. That failed. That closed within a year. Yeah. I think the first year it folded. And all those guys were big enough stars where they went back to the NFL, no questions asked. But
was that before or after their undefeated season? I can't remember.
It was after.
After, yeah.
Yeah. So the undefeated season was 73. I think the World Football League was 74 or 75. But here's the thing. Then you had the XFL, Vince McMahon's XFL. That disappeared too, right? But I will say one thing. The XFL at least had innovation. They tried different things. They got rid of kickoffs. They had the scrum where two guys ran towards the ball, and whoever recovered it first the team got the ball first. It was like a weird thing. But now when you have the USFL, you have the AFL, you have the XFL again, I think all these leagues are jockeying for position, because when you look at something, it sounds crazy, but when you look at something like the NFL Network, they're on 24/7, 365. And I can tell you from personal experience, when I had my radio show on Sirius XM, I wanted to do football year-round. That was my thing. I knew how popular football was. I said, I could talk about football every weekend, year-round. And they said, nobody cares about football until the draft. Nobody cares, you know. And I was like, no. Anyway, long story short, I'm not there, but my ideas are there. Because now there's entire radio shows just dedicated to football 24/7. NFL Network, right? Who would have thought that you could do a football network all year round, right? So now I think these leagues, right, are fighting for position to be the off-season league, right? Obviously, they all want to be the spring league or the summer league.
Right.
My prediction, or what I think will be the first successful league, is the first one that adopts sort of like the baseball minor league system, where each NFL team has a minor league affiliate, for lack of a better term.
So in other words, it'll have to be tied in with the NFL.
Probably. Okay. Because otherwise, it's just – the NFL is too far entrenched right now.
Exactly. The NFL, there's just something magical and special. Right? But real quick to the audience, I am a footnote in the NFL Network's history. I and my partner were their first fantasy analysts. We were forced on Rich Eisen's show. The producers didn't want us. They didn't treat us like dirt, but they were not kind to us. And probably one of my not-so-savvy business moves was standing my ground. And, again, me, John and I have talked about why we are in our positions in life. It's because we have a spine and we have a backbone, and it's not all about money.
And look where it got us.
Yeah. I have a home. I have somebody who loves me. At least my dogs do. So, anyway, the USFL has been in a 37-year hiatus. They returned with an 8-team league. Going to play a 10-week season. It started this past week. Its inaugural postseason is going to take place in the Tom Benson Hall of Fame Stadium in Canton, Ohio, which is remarkable because that's enemy territory. That's the NFL's heart and soul.
Right.
The top two teams of each division will play in the semifinals, and there'll be a championship game in July. So we are in April. The season had just started. It's going to end in July. So what's that, John? About 2.5 months of play there.
About three, yeah.
It has backing. It has more backing than probably Trump gave and the other owners gave their league. Well, I'm lying. They paid a lot of money to players, you know, in the original incarnation. But Fox is backing it with about $150 million for the first 3 years. Let's talk about the teams here. I'm not going to go through every team. I'm just going to mention a couple of them. The Michigan Panthers, headed by Coach Jeff Fisher, and the New Jersey Generals by Coach Mike Riley. What can you tell us about Fisher and Riley?
Well, Jeff Fisher, obviously probably most famously known as the head coach of the Titans.
Super Bowl appearance.
Remarkably 500 coach. That's how
I know. He's so good and only 500.
Like, Jeff Fisher, in my mind, is always the 8-8 coach. Always. No, I mean, and you might disprove me. His actual record might be slightly above or slightly below. But in my mind, my perception is he's always the average coach. I didn't think he was great. I didn't think he was terrible. He was just that middle-of-the-road coach. Good, nice guy, but just middle-of-the-road.
About 15 years, I think, with the Titans and then the season with the Rams. And I think the problem is he has some outstanding seasons. But he had a lot more losing seasons than outstanding seasons. And you know what? I was never a Steve McNair fan. Air McNair from Acorn or wherever he came from.
Yeah.
I just have a belief of small college players. They need time to develop, and they gave him time to develop. But he never acclimated himself to the speed of the game, and he was never a stud QB. He was just an everyday, what I would call, serviceable QB. Not the QB that would take you to the Super Bowl, but a QB that was part of the whole framework of a team going to the Super Bowl. Now, Mike Riley, I can jump in on Riley. He was he was the head coach of the Chargers. He was just, what you call your bland head coach. He was just there. Charged with the Chargers. Eventually, he was let go. I think he became a head coach for a while at Oregon State. He had a couple of stints there. But One guy who was never a head coach is Kirby Wilson, and he's the coach of the Pittsburgh Maulers. Had a long term in the NFL running back. I mean, he's all the position type coaches. And Bart Andrus, the Philadelphia Stars head coach, time with the Titans and Rams. But Riley and Fisher were head coaches from the North Division. Tell me about the South Division and Todd Haley.
Well, Todd Haley is the most famous coach coming out of that, or the most well-known coach. He used to be the Chiefs head coach. And
what did he have the misfortune of?
That's a good question. What did
having Matt Cassel as his QB.
Oh, right. Okay, fair enough. He had the misfortune of paying to get the Patriots garbage to lead his team. But
Not not the QB they all thought he was.
Right, yeah. Like, it's the typical thing. Like, when they're backups, they all look good. They all look good when they're backups. But when you get them, it's rare. There's a reason they were backups on their original team to begin with. The USFL has got some veteran coaches in there that have had NFL coaching experience, some of the guys' coordinator experience. But I don't think anyone's there for the coaching. You know, the USFL also has some players.
But hold on, John. They're not there for the coaching. But what's it say when its biggest names are the coaches?
It says you're a new league.
Fair enough. All right, talk to me about some of the quarterbacks. There's a first-round 26th overall pick in the 2016 NFL draft.
Paxton Lynch.
That's right.
He's in the famous John Elway thought they were as good as he was a club of quarterbacks that he's put on the Broncos at one point or another.
But you know what, though? I'm not a big fan of Elway. He had the – and here's why. He brought Peyton Manning. He'll be remembered for that, but – I'll be frank, Peyton Manning stunk. He was garbage the year they won the Super Bowl. The defense carried him. No one doubts that. No one, but memories get foggy and they forget and they, Peyton Manning with the Broncos. No, he was garbage on there. In fact, it was to the point where Brock Osweiler.
Like,
they didn't know who they should go with. Then they went with Manning because he's older, better, and yada, yada, yada.
Well, Manning had a good year the first season in Denver. Like, he threw like 50 touchdowns that season, but
was it that year? I don't.
It was the year before. Remember. It was the year. Remember. It was the year remember. Before the Super Bowl. Yeah. But I agree with you. The year he won the Super Bowl, he was horrible. He wasn't Peyton Manning at all.
I feel like a New York Jewish man when I say that. He was garbage.
He was garbage.
Is that going to get me in trouble politically speaking?
Not with me.
Well, people know I just jest.
He's gone.
I have a lot of New Yorker relatives, so I love poking fun at my brethren over there.
Isn't that funny? I mean, so do I.
But you know, they have a lot of players that have NFL experience that nobody knows of. Wide receiver Jeff Batted spent years with Washington, Atlanta, and Vegas. Scooby Wright, great name for marketing. Three NFL teams, you know. John Franklin III, one of the main stars, not of the NFL, but I guess he was a big star in the Netflix hit Last Chance U. And
right.
I remember seeing previews. I never watched it. I guess I'm just not into that type of stuff. I'm like, come and show me in the NFL. Then I'm too busy of a man to watch potential. You know, they don't pay me for that. Right. But there's a lot of other players that have experience, and we're not going to go through them because what I want to hit up before we move on are the ratings. You know, John, I'm not too familiar. Maybe you are, and I'm being serious here. It's kind of it's that rating share that I get confused about. Can you explain that, or should we just move on from that?
I'll do it very quickly. And at the end of the day, it doesn't matter which one you use as long as you keep talking about the same one and you don't mix them up. Ratings is how many people watched out of every potential viewer. So a rating, for example, this tends to count individuals, right? Shares are the number of viewers divided by – so it's the number – it's the percentage of viewers out of all the people who actually watch TV in a given snapshot. So one is – ratings is more aspirational, whereas share seems to be – think of it of the pie you baked. What was the share that watched your program? Whereas ratings are the people who watched out of anybody. So ratings count people who weren't watching TV, if that makes sense. share.
I don't know, John. I'm a Latino. At this point, I'm going to my half Japanese brother and having him interpret it for me. You know, with all the math.
Oh, you know those Asians are good at math.
Yeah, my brother's gonna kill me. But no, we're kidding, people. We're kidding. I have family. I can do that, as my other brethren always say. I'm Latino. I can do that. Okay, let's do it this way then. In a nutshell, they aired the game on two networks, Fox and NBC. Fox had 1.76 million. Oh, one of them had 1.76 million viewers. The other one had 1.31 viewers. So what's that? That's close to 3 million viewers. Now, I kind of like broke this down a little bit. 2.95 million viewers. It did well against the playoffs. You know.
Yeah.
That,
yeah.
I don't think you can build a league off of 3 million. It off, Big John. They're playing all their games in Birmingham. How do you build a fan base when your games aren't even in your city?
Well, that's a big problem. I think a lot of it is going to be, if it succeeds at all, it's going to be all digital marketing. You know, it's going to be who do you identify with? Because honestly, you're right. If you're not playing, if you're the New Jersey Generals, the only attachment you have to Jersey fans right now is the name. That's it.
Right.
And that goes for every team in the USFL. So I think their main purpose right now is to just maintain a profitable TV contract. That's what they're hoping for.
Well, they're hoping how much is Fox backing them?
$150 million, I think.
I can't remember. I'm looking it up. Guys, yeah, $150 million. I've seen $300, but that's a lot of cash flow to back it. But that said, and you're alluding, it's. I just don't see how they can do it. Right now, they believe TV ratings and building it, like as you said, is more important than the attendance. I don't think you can do one without the other. I think that's one of those complementary pieces that must be done together.
I agree. And it's counterintuitive. Like, to my knowledge, I don't think there's ever been a league where there was the concept of the home team just didn't exist. I know there have been parts of seasons due to financial reasons. Like, I think in the AFL, the Dallas Texans were homeless for a while. So they had to go to different stadiums. They really didn't have any home games. Yeah. During the pandemic, there were some teams that didn't have home games, right?
Well, the XFL literally died because of the pandemic. But that's what you call the asterisk. You know, John, 40,000 tickets were sold or distributed for Saturday night's game, and that was the first night of it. But yet only 17,500 fans showed up.
Right.
And the second day, there was no number count, but you could barely see the fans. And some people believe, and I can't argue this, I don't know how true it is, but if you have an empty stadium and there's no roaring, I mean, there's that synergy with us on the couch and, the hearing the stadium roar, you know, that gets the energy flowing. And that's the nuance of life, the nuance of success. And I think you need that. Disagree or agree?
Oh, I agree with you. It's the same reason sitcoms have canned laughter. You know,
and you can tell when it's fake, it doesn't work.
Yeah, but at the same time, if you hear silence because it's not filmed in front of an audience, you don't laugh at the jokes either.
Yeah, I mean, no, that's right.
They've done tests where they've played the same episode of a show with and without the laugh track.
The same jokes get
totally different reactions, right? The laughter prompts you to laugh, right? And the same thing with the crowd. If you hear a crowd cheering, you'll get into it. Or booing, you'll get into it. So yeah, this is going to be interesting. So they're going the TV route, and I also think the other thing they're doing, which I give them credit for, is they're trying to be different than the NFL with some rules changes.
Right.
So for example, there's the concept of the 3-point try. So you've got a 1, a 2, and a 3, which means that as long as you're losing by single digits, one score can tie the game potentially. So even if you're down 9, one score in a 3-point try. Onside kicks, they're actually using the rule that the NFL experimented with 2 or 3 seasons ago, which is you could either try an onside kick with all the rules around it, or you could try going for a 4th-and-12 from your own 33. So if you make it, you keep the ball. You don't make it, the other team gets it wherever the dead ball was, right? So that's some strategy, right? Do I go for an onside kick? Right. They're changing the punts a little bit, I think, and the kickoffs.
So, B. John, what you're saying is they're experimenting just as the XFL did. Before right. I get your final comment, because I'm going to ask you what your thoughts are on this overall, there is some controversy. The USFL Mahler's head coach, Kirby Wilson, you know, he was never head coach in the NFL, but had a long, distinguished career as position coach. I mean, he did every job. He cut running back Devion Smith. It's about discipline. It's about focus. It's about understanding the role and what we're all trying to achieve. We all must be healthy. We must do right as a team. You will order the chicken salad for lunch. Everybody will. I guess Devion Smith didn't hear this rule or something, doesn't like chicken salad, and ordered a pizza. And what happened?
He got cut. You just said he got cut. Yeah. Yeah, that's just nonsense. I don't know. There's so much of this I don't understand. First of all, there's much more to be gained by treating grown men like grown men, right? If you're a head coach. The second thing is, if you really were concerned and wanted them to eat chicken salad, why didn't you just order chicken salad for them? Like, the only thing that on the menu is chicken salad.
I think that may have been the case, and he got out. I did not look deeply into the story.
It just sounds crazy to me. Like, why would you – yeah, that seems crazy. Like, I don't know.
But think about it this way, John. Devion Smith, he's in his head thinking – and I guess he's a pretty good tailback. He's thinking, okay, I got my shot here. Maybe I can make a sizzle reel and get back in.
Right.
Now, when they think, well, what do you think of Devion Smith? I don't know. What do you have for lunch? Pizza, chicken salad, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, we're joking about it, but in all seriousness, his dreams have been crushed. There now is no outlet for him unless he goes to the CFL maybe or something like that.
His dreams have been crushed by a crazy coach is what it comes down to because, like, listen, man, if it was repeated or something, I don't know, maybe.
I mean, John, if he had been going to a massage parlor with 20-some-odd women demanding a happy ending or expecting one, I could see getting cut over that.
I could see going with the guy for the 20 happy endings, but yeah, I don't know about cutting him. But, yeah.
Where's your wife at?
Yeah, right. But listen, I just think it's crazy. You're right. It just doesn't make anyone sound good, that story, you know? So, I don't know what to say. I just think it's nuts.
Final comment. Does the league survive or not?
Not.
Now, do you think it's done in 1, 2, 3 years after the $150 million, after 3 years, it folds, or do you think it could even fold before then?
It'll probably fold before the 3-year contract's up. Probably. I mean, I'd like to see it succeed. I think it should.
Fold for the simple reason that most of these new startups, regardless of the league, they start out week 1 or 2 doing well, but then they tend to crater and plateau down. Yeah. And without having built a fan base, we'll talk about this again, and we'll likely be talking about how its ratings have gone from 3 million to 800,000.
But yeah. I will say this. Maybe in general, one of the leagues that's showing up, XFL, AFL, USFL, the fan-controlled league, like if you put them all together, maybe one of them can shake out, you know, because honestly, competition, as a libertarian, competition brings out the best of everybody.
You're right, John.
It's unhealthy. It's unhealthy for the NFL to be the only game in town, literally.
And that's just it, though. That's what makes it unique. This is not a similar situation where that belief works because for some reason they just have a lock. It's like MLB. If they try to have a professional league account, I just think we are so set with the NFL, MLB, NBA. It's literally that medieval castle that's impregnable, and you're going to spend months upon months just trying to even, you know, scale the walls without success.
Right. If every competitor league just tries to be the carbon copy of the main league, in this case, if the USFL was trying to be just a carbon copy of the NFL just in the spring, it would always fail. You got to take the approach like the AFL did. I'm bringing something new to the table. You recognize it as football, but it's something different.
The XFL did that. Remember Rod Smart, Hot Rod Smart?
Yeah, you know, he hate me. That was
yeah, he hate me. That's it. He hate me. You know, so I want them to succeed, and for the one reason I want these players and coaches to be able to showcase themselves and move on to the next level. Again, why? Because I can see myself in that camp trying to overachieve in the NFL. Okay, let's move forward. John, this is kind of your segment. I requested this segment for the simple fact my friend Jackie, God bless her soul, who I went to elementary school, then junior high, then she disappeared for many years, and we rediscovered each other on Facebook. You know, and my wife knows about her, so we're good.
Oh, man, there goes my blackmail.
Yeah. She's just a friend. But she tweeted to me about why am I promoting Gilbert Gottfried with the rest in peace, rest in peace, because he passed away, yada, 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 because she said he supports pedophilia. And Jackie just did not know the story behind it. And I got aggravated because we are in a society of, we're just bombarded. People don't realize this, but when I started my company, the first thing I learned and realized through research and wanting to build a strong business was how people read on the internet. They don't read, they skim. So they don't read a whole story. They just read the bullet points, the headlines. Right. You know, it's why politics can be so easily manipulated more than it could ever be in the past, which is a scary thing considering how it could be manipulated in the past. So that brings us to Gilbert Gottfried and something called the aristocrats, something that is a familiar, not the phrase, but what it's about. You hear on every sailor birthing. It's what Donald Trump kind of talked about, that he tried to demonize him, where every man goes, what are you talking about? That's how locker room talk is. Whether right or wrong, it's crass, it's mean, it's taboo, and I will let you take it away from there, and I'm just going to ask you questions now. Yeah. First of all, a little bit of details, Gilbert Gottfried, rest his soul. Tell me about his passing, and then from there, what are the aristocrats?
Right, so Gilbert Gottfried, we went into it last week, last episode rather. He passed away at 67. He had that whiny, piercing New York Jewish voice. He was a voice actor. He was a stand-up comedian. He also did some mainstream acting.
And for the record, that's how he was described, as the whiny Jewish high.
Yes, yes.
So nobody jump on Big John.
Yeah, like maybe the mainstream wouldn't throw Jewish in there, but it was, you know, they'd say like the annoyingly boisterous, you know, unrecognizable voice of, you know.
Well, Godfrey would throw out the annoying Jewish voice.
And listen, Gilbert Godfrey had a great sense of humor about it. He would always refer to himself as an annoying Jew. He would always throw that in there, right? But anyway, so he died of a congenital condition, meaning it's something he was born with. It basically caused his heart to beat arrhythmically, and eventually his heart gave out. He had a heart attack, basically, and he died at 67. He was known in comedic circles as being I heard something by Bill Maher. Not that I love Bill Maher, but he had a great comment. He said Gilbert Gottfried was the king of too soon. He never missed an opportunity to make a crass joke immediately after a tragic event. So after the tsunamis hit Japan, he famously made a joke about the tsunami. On Twitter, he got fired by Aflac. He was the voice of the duck.
Aflac.
Right? He was the voice of the duck. He was making.
Why was he fired?
For making the tsunami joke when all those people died in Japan.
Yeah. Aflac's business, 70-some-odd percent of their business came from Japan.
Crazy, yeah. But he didn't care. He always, on the Howard Stern show, he was famous for dropping the N-word during the news segment. He just did it constantly, and even Howard Stern would blush back in the day. But he thought it was hilarious, and part of his thought was a comedian's mindset, which was, the more I use these taboo words, the less power they have to inflict pain on people. So the N-word, referring to Jews outright,
Like Richard Pryor used to do with the N-word.
Richard Pryor used to do that with the N-word. A lot of today's comedians do that with the N-word. Some women use it when they use the word bitch to refer to themselves because, again, they're taking the same playbook. A lot of these female comedians, especially the stand-ups, will use bitch as a – I hate the phrase empowerment, but they use it to take away the power the word has that others can wield against you. So that's the concept behind it, which
there's
I agree.
There's the reasoning for it.
There's the reasoning for it, and honestly, I agree with it. I told you, I'm not a stand-up comedian, but I think I have a stand-up sensibility.
That's your sensibility. Way to be a stand-up comedian.
Yeah, but I have their sensibility. So Gilbert was that type of guy. People forget he had an encyclopedic mind for when it came to Hollywood, movies, TV. He could tell you who was a supporting player in a movie from 1940. If you listen to him doing his routines on Georgie Jessel, and I guarantee you don't know who Georgie Jessel is, because no one does. Georgie Jessel was a guy who did vaudeville back in the 30s in blackface.
Wow.
And he would do Georgie Jessel references, and people would be, who's Georgie Jessel? And he was the guy who would be, mama, I'm on the phone, mama. You know, it was like stupid crap like that, you know. Yeah, yeah. But he made it hilarious. Like I said, if you go to the YouTube, there's tons of his podcasts, the Gilbert Gottfried Amazing Colossal Podcast. I can't recommend it enough. Hilarious.
John, what you're also describing is a Gilbert Gottfried that seems to be two people. There was this persona, the voice of Aladdin, the Affleck guy.
Right.
Yeah, SNL is tame compared to what you're talking about. So it seems like a split personality individual here. But now, what is the Aristocrats?
So the Aristocrats it wasn't invented by Gilbert Gottfried.
Right.
The Aristocrats started in vaudeville in the 20s and 30s. Now, the Aristocrats, keep in mind, this was never a public act. It was never done for audiences. It was done among comedians.
Yeah.
And it was done – so think of it as two rappers doing the dozens with each other, right?
Oh, that's like, right. People like, don't realize that. In the old days of rap, they were kind of rap at each other.
Yeah, battle raps and stuff.
Yeah.
But for the most part, that wasn't done for audiences. It was done among rappers. It was sort of a way of who's better or who's going to come out on top. So the Aristocrat was this joke, and it's a very simple joke in terms of its complexity, right? It's set up, long storytelling, and then the punchline. Now, the funny thing is the setup and the punchline are always the same.
Oh,
the setup is a man, his wife, and two kids go into a talent agent's office. That's always the setup. And the punchline is always, what do they call you? The Aristocrats. Those are the two things that never change about the joke. Right. Never change.
But why is that? To show that they're uppity elite people, yet they've done all this crass talk?
It's the opposite. It's that they're horrible, disgusting people who will do anything to be famous. What do you call yourselves? The Aristocrats. Now, Eric Idle said the joke doesn't work, ironically, in England, because in England, everybody knows that the dirtiest, most vile people on the planet are the Aristocrats.
So unless it's America's love of how we look at the Queen, high society,
right,
the life.
Right.
Gotcha.
Eric Idle, who is from Monty Python, famously said, in England, the joke works not when you use the Aristocrats as the punchline, but when you use the Sophisticates as
the
punchline.
Okay, that's right. Gosh,
right?
Memory's back.
Yeah, so anyway, so that's the setup. Now, the key is the middle part. So typically it'll be man, wife, two kids, and their family dog walks into a talent agent's office. Father says, hey, man, have we got a great act for you? I can't wait to do it. So the agent says, okay, show me what it is, and I'll figure out if I can book you. And immediately, ba-bam, that's when it starts. The father starts having sex with the mother. The mother starts having sex with the dog starts having sex with the baby. It's sex with everybody. There's bodily functions. There's kids involved, bestiality, anything you could think of.
And that's the whole purpose.
That's the whole purpose.
Now, that's how you would do it.
Right. Now, again, remember –
and that would include pedophilia, too.
Pedophilia,
right?
Bestiality, torture, everything you could think of. Because it was meant to be the worst thing you could come with. And that's for two reasons. The first is the dichotomy, right? These people are doing the most horrible things you could think of. And at the same time, they're calling themselves the aristocrats. Yeah, that's exactly part of the joke. The real thing is that comedians, again, never for the audience, the comedians would do it to see, the part of the rules were, how long could you make this joke last?
Right.
And how long could you go without repeating acts of depravity within the joke?
Right.
So, for example, once you had the mother and the son doing incest, you couldn't repeat that again. If you did, you lost. Right.
So it was, I forget how to explain it, but what you're saying is, whoop, that one's been down, can't do it again.
Right, now go on, think of something else. Right, think of something else. Now, there were some people that I heard of just hanging around comedians who were famous for this joke among other comedians. One of them, believe it or not, was Bob Saget. Bob Saget, who also passed away recently, right, was one of those guys who could talk for an hour, be filthy dirty, and not repeat himself. He was one of the practitioners of this who had really started to get legendary status. The other one was Gilbert Gottfried, except no one outside of the comedy community knew about it. Where he broke it out and where it became famous, if you go on YouTube, you can see this.
This is where the public found out about
this.
This
is when the public, more of the public, found out about, A, about the aristocrats, and B, about the genius of Gilbert Gottfried. It was right after 9/11. There was a benefit a charity benefit to raise money for the firefighters, the victims of 9/11 in New York. And of all people, Hugh Hefner decided that he would allow himself to be roasted at the New York Friars Club.
California and New York, the Friars Club, for people who are young, in the 60s, 70s, they were the bomb.
Well, the Friars Club, going back, the Friars literally are, think of it as the private club of comedians.
Right,
only comedians could get in. Nothing. It's like a union. They only let each other in, right? Like
nothing was taboo.
Nothing was taboo, and the old vaudeville guys were in there. So anyway, they're doing the roast, and it's very tense in New York. You have to understand, there were still people being dug out of the rubble when they did this. There was still the smoke over Lower Manhattan. There were still buildings on fire when this thing was going on.
Wasn't it about 18 days, 3 weeks?
I don't remember the exact time, but people were still grieving. Nobody knew if you could laugh or not. And it's, I can't overstate this enough, having lived through it. Like, you didn't know what you were supposed to laugh at. You didn't know what was funny. You didn't know what was appropriate. So at the thing, there were all these other comedians on the stage. Jimmy Kimmel, Dick Gregory, I think, was there. There was Adam Carolla was there. Sarah Silverman. So it was a lot of big-name comedians.
Big beam comedians.
Yeah, Rob Schneider famously, because he kept laughing.
You know what? You're saying these comedians and not, I mean, it's like the minor league team when you think of great comedians like Carlin, Pryor.
Well, they weren't around. That was the whole point, because not a lot of people could fly.
No. I'm just saying how much comedy has fallen.
Well, maybe that, but also I think it was just logistics. Like, if they weren't in New York to begin with, odds are they weren't going to fly to New York.
True.
So anyway, Gilbert gets on, and the crowd is still tense, and he gets up at the podium, and he makes this joke. He goes, I hope you people don't mind, but I can't stay too long because I have to catch a flight to California very soon. I have to make connecting flights at the Empire State Building. Silence throughout the crowd. Just silence. You could hear a pin drop, and then within a few seconds, you could hear the boos. Boo, boo.
Some people holler too soon.
Yes, and then you could hear one guy in particular somewhere in the depths go, too soon. And you could see people didn't know what to make of it. And in the split second, you could see Gilbert, who never was afraid to say anything. All of a sudden, he's calculating in his head. You could see him. He's nervous. He's always a nervous guy. He was always fidgety.
Would you say this is the intellectual genius you're referring to at this moment?
This moment, he decided, and there was a documentary where I have to give credit to the writer from The New Yorker. He's the one who actually formulated this thought was, in that moment, Gilbert didn't know what to do. So what did he do when, like most of us, when we're uncertain? we go back to what we know. We go back to what we trust. So in his mind, very quickly, he's like, I'm at the Friars Club. All these comedians up on the dais are my friends. Let's play a game of the aristocrats. So you could see at one point he was like sweaty and everything, and then he just looked up and he literally went like this. Okay, there's this family, and they walk into a talent agent's office. And as he starts this, I think Bill Maher said it a couple of nights ago on Jimmy Kimmel's show. He said the first 6 minutes of that joke, the crowd still hadn't gotten over to Gilbert's side. They were like,
they're still in shock.
Because now they're hearing about incest and pedophilia and bestiality, and they're like, what the hell is going on here? Because remember, most of that crowd did not know anything about the aristocrats joke. The people who were dying laughing were on the stage. The other comedians, as soon as he said, this family walks into a talent agent's office, if you watch the video of that, you can see the other comedians, half of them are going, oh, no, he's not going to do the aristocrats, is he? The other half, you could see them start to giggle because they're like, oh, yeah, he's going to do the aristocrats because we know Gilbert. He's that type of mentality.
Oh, he had to save himself, too. I mean, that joke.
Well, yeah, that first joke bombed. I don't want to say that
people hate him or bombed, but it fell as flat as flatter than what people thought the earth was.
As Patrice O'Neill said, that bomb was worse than somebody strapping one to their back in Palestine and running to Israel.
And that's like a Patrice joke,
too. That was a Patrice joke. But anyway, by the time he got done with his rendition of the aristocrats, which, by the way, I think lasted between 12 and 15 minutes. He just kept it going and going and going. There were comedians on the dais who had fallen on the floor from all the laughter with tears running down their eyes. They were laughing so hard.
I just don't find that funny, though.
But here's the funny thing. They weren't laughing because of the joke. The joke itself was irrelevant.
Yeah.
It was how long, Jeffrey Ross said this, to us, the thing we were laughing about was how long could he keep this going with an audience that has clearly never heard this before, probably entirely revolted at the content. How long could he keep it going? And that was the genius, that in that moment, he pulled something out of his butt to save himself, and in doing so, save the audience, because the laugh that came out of that was so cathartic. Everyone in the room afterwards said, we needed that. We needed to laugh at something so crazy and stupid because of what was going on in New York at the time that they all thanked them afterwards. And to this day, if you take a poll of comedians, what is the greatest telling of any joke on the planet? Gilbert Gottfried's rendition of the aristocrats at that Friars Roast is considered probably the best telling of any single joke ever. That it was just amazing.
And you know what, John? I mean, we'll forget he was the Aflac voice. We'll forget about Aladdin. I forgot about Aladdin already. But at the end of the day, he was not a top-tier comedian per se like some of the others. But it's kind of like you and I. We're pioneers of fantasy sports. People may not know us, but we cemented our lore in his
legacy.
Nobody can take that away from us. And in that moment, I believe Gilbert Gottfried cemented his legacy in the comedic world. Because 60 years from now, 100 years from now, that tale it's a footnote in history, and he'll never be forgotten. And God bless his soul. My final question to you before we close out the show: can the aristocrats be pulled off today without being canceled? I mean, without the person who pulls it off being canceled, if it happens in public versus comedic circles?
I think so, but only for one reason. Because of Gilbert. Because I think...
Well, that's Gilbert.
I'm saying because Gilbert did it.
Oh, okay.
And because now it's understood to be what it is. Like, your friend Jackie is probably one of a few that took him seriously. Like, I don't know anyone who ever took Gilbert Gottfried seriously. There are people who have been upset at him because he made funny of something that offended them personally. But if someone says, I'm doing my version of the aristocrats right now, no one's going to say, oh, my God. There'll be people who walk out. There'll be people who boo. But cancel? I don't think so.
I want to believe you. I mean, just to give you the example tonight, the reason I said, man, John, I'm asking my half Asian brother, I said it as half a joke, but he's like, 10 times smarter than me. So I'm like, yeah, hey, bro, explain that to me. But yeah, people take everything so differently nowadays. Or like I had to explain, all right, audience, John's not picking on Jews here. That's how Godfrey would describe himself as well.
Right. It's a shame that it has to come to that. And to be honest with you, I think I told you once when you asked me, like, John, why do you sometimes use such horrible language, or why are you so, you know, whatever? It's precisely of that reason, because I'm at the age where I can own the platform I speak on, like we are now. I'd rather remind people that it's always better to have too much free speech than too little.
And you know you're destroying my political career, though.
Yeah, hey, no one forced you to be on this show. But but literally, to me, there's no such thing as too much free speech. The more, the better. The fewer restrictions, the better. Your friend Jackie, I'm not belittling her if she actually thought this was a pedophile, if Gilbert was a pedophile. She's wrong, obviously. I mean, he's got two or three kids that survive him. And anyone you talk to will say, in real life, there was no Gilbert character. Yeah. Gilbert Gottfried was one of the quietest, gentlest people, wouldn't hurt a mouse, adored his family. His wife is like 15 years younger than him, but...
Ooh, Robin the Cradle. He had a couple kids, too.
And she was devoted to him, and his children devoted to him, and he was devoted to them. The only thing I'll throw in, legendary cheapskate.
Oh, was he?
Everyone says, like...
I'm staying away from that.
He never... Oh, no, I'll say it for you. Gilbert would say, he goes, well, I got to live up to being a Jew. Right? Because that was his punchline, right? So what I'm saying is I could see where people get offended by him, and they might say, I don't want to listen to him. That's cool. But to have people say we can't play his jokes because he uses this language, to me is horrible. And by the way, it goes to any comedian.
You know, it's funny you say that because eventually I learned how to dance. I mean, let's be honest, to pick up a chick, I'm like, I got to learn how to dance again on that nightclub floor. But I remember at the prom, I remember my friend, dude, what the hell's the matter with you? You're the only freaking Puerto Rican I know with two left feet. You know, I guess technically today, that should offend me, huh? But to your point, it's like we laugh, you know? It's we just live in a world that's aggravating, scary, and disgusting. To me, that's true disgust. Yeah, when somebody plays the soapbox morality from behind their computer without looking in the mirror, it's sickening, you know. So, John, we've actually run over time. This was a great show, I think. I have actually been doing a lot of research for future topics, but I want to plead our case to the audience. Look, we're starting now. We don't have a lot of viewers, so those of you viewing us, thank you. But make sure you share. You share the our podcast, because we're growing. I mean, I'm proud to say, I took my previous company from nothing. People told us, you're not going to succeed. You can't do what you're doing at your pace. And I'm like, yeah, watch. And we're saying the same thing here, but we do need your help. And we got some great, exciting topics coming up ahead. We're going to talk about Herschel Walker's political run. We're going to talk about cities in California just making crap up to be able to tax streaming companies like Netflix and Hulu. Oscar De La Hoya talking about Jake Paul can be a boxing champion. The Great White Hope or the Great White Joke. Tony Dungy being thrown under the bus just because he believes in fathers. You know, Royce White, former NBA player, running for Congress. And John, we got others, Daniel Snyder, but one that I know you'll appreciate, we're going to talk about free speech. That's what we've got lined up for the next three shows. We are a blend of politics, sports, and I'm no longer saying pop culture, I'm saying culture. Politics, sports, and culture. That is what we are talking about. And if we can't laugh at ourselves, or if I can't laugh at you, damn it, then why are we here? Final words, Big John.
I can't top that. Although I would add sports, politics, culture, and sexy.
Ladies, we know you want him, but you got to stand in line. He's married. And with that, we bid you good night, and a special good night to my friend Jackie. Y'all take care.
Peace out, y'all.